This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We will start with meditation today. So the usual Thai instruction is: put your right leg on top of your left leg, your right hand on top of your left hand. If you can't do that, then
do that part.
Get in our meditation posture. When I meditate, I like to bring up the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha in my heart. So I usually just recite something like Buddha Minato, Dhamma Minato, Sangha Minato, Buddha, Buddha, Dhamma, Dhamma, Sangha, Sangha. And then bring up the Brahmaviharas, metta, metta, chit, the heart of benevolence, karuna, karuna, chit, the heart of compassion, mudita, mudita, chit, the heart of appreciation, appreciative joy, and upeka, upeka, chit, the heart of equanimity. So having found the suitable posture, mind set up well, either we could recite Buddha mentally, or Buddha with the in-breath and the out-breath, and just watch the in-breath coming in and the out-breath going out. By putting our attention here, try and make the in-breath sabai at ease, the out-breath sabai at ease. As we focus just on the in-breath wind, just point of contact, out-breath wind, just point of contact, and find that the whole experience begins to settle. Make sure the body is relaxed, eyes are closed, not tightly, but gently. Meditation, we're giving up sense contact. Don't worry about sights or sounds or smells or tastes or touch or mental concoctions. Don't worry about moods or feelings that arise. We just keep directing the mind in a gentle and patient way back to the in-breath, back to the out-breath. On a mantra, it can be Bud with the in-breath, Do with the out-breath, Bud, Do. By having a simple object, not concerned with anything in the world, the mind begins to settle down. Try and cultivate a sense of ease. Ease with the in-breath. Ease with the out-breath. What's the feeling of the breath? Right at the point of contact. As we focus on the in-breath and the out-breath, everything else begins to settle down and vanish. the feeling of the breath, mentally reciting the word Buddha in a gentle way, using Buddha with the in-breath or out-breath, whatever our chosen means was, we just gently and patiently sustain that. Diligent apprentice. You might think of like a bellows. A bellows on a fire. It opens and closes. It's like an in-breath and an out-breath. We have all of our attention placed at this one point. Know the in-breath. Know the out-breath. Cultivate an inner sense of seclusion, an island in our own heart. Sabai, a sense of ease. We keep coming back to sense of ease, knowing the in-breath. Sense of ease, knowing the out-breath. The total attention. Content with whatever is, not proud and demanding in nature. Sense of ease with the in-breath. Sense of ease with the out-breath. Who is the one who knows the in-breath? Who is the one who knows the out-breath? Just keep continuing this cultivation, ease. continues to sharpen. Rest of the meditation, we just do our best next 15 minutes to sustain our chosen theme, and also to overcome any hindrances. If we're dull, imbue the mind with luminosity. If we're restless, we try and let the mind become quiet. We just bring the mind back into the middle, this neutral place where peace can arise, cultivating the sense of sabai, of ease, with our chosen theme. Thank you. as you wish. And just continue meditating with your eyes closed. During the talk, or you may open your eyes and end the meditation. See the result, half an hour of meditation. I was listening to some talks by Lumpur Pliam the other day, and he said 6 months was a good amount of time to see if your meditation objects works. And that's if you're a monk living in a monastery practicing a lot. So meaning that, you know, that's, to really give a meditation object a chance, we've got to stick with it and really try, you know. If we just keep digging shallow little holes and saying, oh, it doesn't suit me, does it not mind, not for me, it must be another object. But in the Dhammapada, which is the small verses of the Buddha says an untrained mind is like a fish thrashing in shallow water. You imagine a fish in a puddle or something, thrashing. And so any time we feel we can't meditate, or life is too busy, or things are difficult, and we've got monkey mind, just remind ourselves it's just a fish thrashing in shallow water. This is the result of a mind that's not trained. So we shouldn't be expecting something else. It's because the mind isn't trained, that's what is being experienced. That's what we're experiencing. And so if we don't want to experience that, then we've got to work out how to train the mind. And in the West, people seem to be very interested in meditation. But of course, it's a gradual training. And to be able to meditate, to make it easier for ourselves, then there's many supporting factors. So, like, we have the Triple Gem with the refuges, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. We have the precepts, and the purpose of maintaining pure morality is because then your mind... A friend of mine contacted me recently, was asking, you know, some help with mindfulness and meditation. I said, well, really, you've got to go back to these things, you know. The purpose of the precepts is they brighten the mind. You know, when you're somebody who doesn't kill, at some point, to get that into your heart, then you need to have benevolence. You need to have compassion for all beings. You know, that's the thing that protects somebody. To have that in their mind, it means you have to be watching your thoughts. Because if you're allowing anger ever to arise in your mind, that's still a seed that could kill a being. So I mean, these are very refined states. On one stage, yes, don't kill a human. But another stage, even seeds of anger in our mind that we can't extinguish quickly, they may arise, but we extinguish them. You know, that's a difficulty. And then killing, stealing. You know, it's not a very good world when people steal things. So we teach ourselves the value of not stealing. So we wouldn't even steal a pin from somebody's house without asking. You know, and, you know, something's cast out, you know, in the forest in the middle of nowhere and it doesn't have an owner, that's one thing. But if it's like on your neighbor's lawn, maybe not. You know, maybe you should knock on their door or just leave it there. You might not make very good neighbors. And so each of the precepts are killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. So the coarsest kind of sexual misconduct is you know, you don't look for your teacher's wife or one of your relatives. So basically, so the worst side of it is so the world doesn't digress into goats and dogs or whatever animals are like that. And so that's the coarsest. But the most refined level is, well, in the lay world, if you have a partner or somebody, then you don't even think thoughts. You don't allow thoughts about other people. And also, you know, moderation in those things, so they don't consume, they're not a fire. So it's like proper proportions. So there's sexual misconduct, so the mind is well guarded. And then if, like the monks, we have celibacy, so then that's another level of that precept. So you don't allow those things to arise in the mind, or you know how to extinguish them. And then lying. So lying is, you know, the worst one is like if a king, you know, and brings you in front of his ministers and he says, "Now come, tell us the truth. What did you see?" And then you deliberately lie. So that's the worst kind of lie, when you've been asked in a proper situation to tell the truth, and then you still deliberately lie. But then the smallest kind of lie is even just lying as a joke. You're lying to get a rise out of somebody in a funny way. But the problem with lying is even if you lie as a joke, now that person won't know if they can trust what you can say. You know? So, you know, if you tell them it's a joke, or you do it in a way where it's clearly a joke, it's one thing. But so that's the extent of it. And then some of them, these are difficult things as well, because intention comes into play. So, like as a monk, you know, I don't kill any insects, but every now and then you may not be paying attention, and then so you do kill something. But because there's no intention there, you know, you're not deliberately killing any being in that scenario, then there's no offense. But at the same time, this is why we train ourselves in mindfulness. So, for example, if somebody's rambling and talking away, they may lie about something or say a non-truth. But because there was no mindfulness there, there was no real intention. So it's somewhere between a lie and idle chatter. But the point is we try and fix up our mindfulness so we can start to see into these things. And then the last one is drugs and alcohol. And so in Buddhism, this is another one we try and refrain from, because while in the teachings it actually says that drugs and alcohol lead to insanity in future lives. And also, the problem with drugs and alcohol is when people take drugs and alcohol, at that time it's far easier to break the other precepts. And at that time you're not interested in meditation, you're not interested in spiritual things. It's very hard. There's a great story of one of the disciples of the Buddha, an arahant, so an enlightened being. And he had the ability with his psychic powers to fight nagas and stuff. They're not killing each other, but he had that ability where, you know, some nagas can breathe fire and all sorts of things. And so he had great psychic power, but some lay people gave him some alcohol in his meal. And he was totally drunk because he had this. And so this is where the rule for the monks come from. And the Buddha said, in the past, this monk, you know, could wield great psychic powers, and now he's drunk. He couldn't even fight a lizard. So the idea is that even an enlightened being, if they consume these things, they're going to dull their mind. But the precepts in Buddhism are just training rules, so they're not, you know, absolute things. But what you do is you just see which ones are we already doing, or which ones can we easily perfect. And, you know, before I became a monk, I think I used to break almost all of them. I was pretty good on the non-killing one, but not so good on the others. And so it just takes time to look. But what they do is when you fix these things up, is it starts to create a mind that's blameless. And so at the time of the Buddha, in ancient times, they have the moon calendar. So in a month, there's the full moon and the new moon, and then there's a moon observance day between them. So you have four observance days in a month. And so that's a good way. You just have these 4 days in a month where they're days we just focus on the precepts and see where we're at. Because until we have these things as a solid base, it's very hard for the mind to have a sense of blamelessness. But once we have these things and we know that these become like a treasure to us, and we're not yoking ourselves to them to beat other people over the head with, we're only yoking ourselves to them because this is the way to develop a peaceful mind. Because when we have these things, you know, if you're not lying anymore, well, you don't have to remember your web of lies. If you're not killing anymore, well, probably nobody's going to look to kill you. You know, that's the problem. Like a king gets killed and somebody becomes a king, and then the family members of the last king come and kill him, and then the family members of that king come and kill him. So it's just like hatred never ends through hatred. And so each of these are basically like fires that burn us. And but whether we see that or not, you know, we have to see that in our own experience. Is this true or is this not true? And it's just a slow process. And so by having something like those 4 days a month, they're just days where we try and see if that's true. And do a bit more meditation and practice on those days. Because the problem with life is the days and nights are relentlessly passing. And so we have to ask ourselves, how well are we spending our time? You know, are we really making use of the opportunities that we have? Because what mental states and what qualities have we come into this life with? And how much have we really developed ourselves? Because most of us are already relatively comfortable. You know, we have a roof over our head, we have clothing, we have food and drink. And so that's the basic requirements for life. Many people don't even have, many people find it very difficult to even get these things in the world. And so we have an opportunity where our lives are already good enough that now it's an added thing we can do is look into our minds and see, you know, how to develop these things. And so that's the precepts. And there's another one called the eight precepts, where on those moon observance days, you can take the extra precept of celibacy and basically sleeping on a simple bed on the floor and not wearing scents and garlands and not being involved with entertainment. And so basically you turn that day where you're basically like a renunciant on that day. You turn it into a spiritual day. And what that does is that even you give up even more suffering, because previously you always, in the world, you have all of these things that you can do with your time. And usually they involve sense contact. And that sense contact stirs the mind up. And so the more the mind is stirred up, the harder it is to ever find any peace. So it's just kind of a way of being like a monk 4 days a month, you know. And I know one person who does it just 1 day a month. He does it down at Serpentine. And over the years, it's greatly improved his life. And usually also they wear white, because you even can renounce color on that day. So you just wear white and just live simply. And so that's just an example. It's in the Buddhist tradition. So if you go to Asian countries, if you go to the forest monasteries on these moon days, we see many lay people coming to the temples, observing these things all day. So it's still very much alive in the world. And the Buddha said that somebody who practices the precepts, you know, looks after their mother and father, does the observances, and that's enough for a heavenly rebirth. It's not a small thing. And so even if people don't make it to the first level of enlightenment in this life, of Sotapanna or beyond that, at least they're cultivating a good heart. And so it's just one example of what people can do. But I'm just saying this because if people really want a peaceful mind, peace, true peace, comes through renunciation. And but as I was saying to my friend, you know, you've got to come back to the foundation. And like generosity is another great one. Some people, maybe they're not so good on meditation. So then you focus on the generosity. And so you go out of your way to give dana to monks and nuns and do all of the things in your life with a generous mind, with a thankful and grateful mind. And so you're going against that grain of the mind of miserliness and complaining and training the mind to be thankful and grateful and always live with like a pure intention. So there's different ways to practice, but they're all about cultivating the heart in a good way. And we can't look at another person. Like, what is good for us? You know, nobody else knows our mind, you know. And by the way, I look at it is you start with one major thing that's like the most difficult thing in your life. Tackle that first, and then always keep that in mind, and then slowly work on other things one at a time. Like maybe you want to work on gossip. Gossip doesn't help anybody. It's speaking divisive speech about people and is not a useful thing. So it's not that we don't say the truth, but what was the mind that was saying that? You know, are we trying to divide people with this speech? And so just by learning to shut our mouth with harsh speech and gossip, we're already restraining ourselves. And when we restrain ourselves in that way, it's going to be easier to restrain our mind. And so, you know, whether we're developing the generosity, the precepts, or restraint in speech, all of these things require samadhi. What is samadhi? Samadhi, in the West, when we say the word meditation, that's what we're talking about. Meditation means samadhi. That's the word they translate. But samadhi really means strength of mind. It's our ability to sustain our mind on a positive thought. And the Buddha was very much like, if a king came to him and he wasn't interested in, you know, enlightenment, he wasn't interested in meditation, he would just teach him, you know, the 10 truths that a king should live by, you know, like, love all of your subjects as if they were your children, I think was one of them. And another thing we can do is just look how we can live our life well, you know, in our job or when we're washing dishes or in our daily chores, rather than just letting our mind think whatever it wants, we try and become mindful of our body posture or mindful of our breath or mindful, put our mind into what we're doing. And we do things well. And we use that as a way of purifying our mind. That a way of training our mind. And some people are more peace-orientated and some people are more thinking-orientated. So they need to use their wisdom first. And that wisdom leads to peace. But if you just think all the time, then that's only going to lead to unease and proliferation. So all of these various areas lay a foundation. And as I've taught many times before, we have these Brahma Viharas, and that's really something that we can all cultivate. And that's like the wish of benevolence to ourselves and all beings, and the wish of compassion, and may all beings be free from suffering, from difficulty, from anxiety. It's like a happy thought. It's a joyful, happy thought. And then appreciative joy. And this is where we recollect, you know, have the thought, may beings not be parted from their good results. So, you know, when a being does a good action, there's a good result. So may they enjoy that good result. May they make use of that good result in the future. Because in the West, you know, they have science of, you know, we know gravity and cause and effect in that way. But in Buddhism, the Buddha teaches cause and effect, that there's action and the result of action. And so if we have a result we don't like, then we need to change the cause of that. And so this is why, just by developing mindfulness, mindfulness is the supreme teaching, because the more we become mindful, then everything starts to become clearer. But we need a system to keep ourselves on track, because we don't have any teacher cracking a whip, and we don't have anybody looking over our shoulder, unless, you know, we actually go find a teacher and can go back to them for advice. But we need to learn to be our own teacher. We've got to be our own teacher and student, and in the sense we take things on and then we try and practice it. And then we have a method of learning what is good and discarding what is not good. And then in the future, you know, we can take on more things. And sometimes we go back and pick up things we discarded in the past and look at them again. And it's this process of evolving. And so if we have anger, then we need to develop a lot of benevolence. If we have laziness, we need to develop a lot of energy, you know. If we have a lot of greed, then we need to develop moderation and sense restraint. And if we have passion, maybe we should contemplate death and sickness and things that teach us the truth about life. And so depending on what our strong defilements are, then that will give us a good understanding of where we should focus our minds. And so this is where... this is the purpose of the meditation, because everywhere you go, people teach meditation, and mainly they teach us to have a peaceful mind. And what is that peaceful mind to do? It's to purify our hearts. And so the mind that we're trying to develop is a mind of a neutral state. So where it's not caught up in sense desires, it's not caught up in anger, it's not caught up in dullness and drowsiness, it's not caught up in restlessness and worry, and it's not doubting. So all of those things are gone. And then so there's just mindfulness in the present. And whenever those other states arise, that's fine. You know, that's just the fish thrashing in shallow water. That's just the untrained mind. And, you know, the one that I usually teach is that, you know, just start with 1 minute every hour. You know, 1 minute every hour. Just try and stop and be with the breath for a minute. Or try and be super mindful for that 1 minute. Or like every time you walk down the corridor in your house, make that a time where you just walk slowly and you're aware of the footsteps. Because quite often, just this little incremental means of developing mindfulness means at that time where we can give our full attention for 1 minute, because that's something that's doable. Now, if we do 10 minutes, maybe we're going to start thinking about other things. And so we start with something simple, because then that will support the meditation. So then when we sit down to meditate in the evenings or the early mornings or whenever we meditate, we haven't let the kettle go cold. Now it's still almost ready to boil. Because if we just wait to do our meditation to get a bit of peace, and we go back into life, and we get lost in all of our mental states, and we come back and get a little bit of peace. Ajahn Chah said that's the very slow way of practicing. And slow and painful, we're still practicing. We'll get there in the end, but we don't have to. It doesn't have to be that way. And so if we can add the metta and a nice way of the benevolence, the metta, it's like a cup, Lumpur Ted said, it's like a cup in your own heart. And first you have to fill the cup in your own heart. And then that cup overflowing, it means that your metta gets stronger and goes out to all beings. But you don't have to actually direct your mind out to all beings. You just focus in on your own heart and fill the cup right there. And because until we have these good mental states, which we can bring up whenever we like, you know, that's the point when we have samadhi, where we can meditate. But without the supporting mindfulness, without the other supporting factors, it's very hard for the mind to settle down. And in the first stage of meditation, you get a thing called Kanika Samadhi. And that's where the mind just starts to drop into peace. So sometimes you just sit down and it's like the mind will just totally stop. The breath will stop. And there's just this, you know, 10, 20, 30 seconds, minute of peace or something. And so this is like the fruit of our practice when all of those conditions are arising. And then the more peace we get, then the power, more power comes into our wisdom, the more power comes into our mindfulness. Because what's happening is previously we're reacting to all of our sense contact all day long. And sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch and thoughts, and we're liking this and we're disliking that. So by the time we go to bed, our minds are just on fire. And so we get this mindfulness, and why I say every hour, because at least then every hour you're able to stop any of your mental states. So you're putting a fence every hour around whatever is arisen in that hour, and you're bringing the mind back to mindfulness. And then the more that power grows, then maybe, you know, on the weekend then you do 5 minutes every hour. And the goal is to get our mindfulness so it grows more and more and more. And eventually, what arises is a thing called the four foundations of mindfulness, which is like in that teaching is the whole of the Buddha's teachings. But the Buddha always says mindfulness of the body is supreme. So like mindfulness of the body posture, like is my arm extending, is it coming back? Even when you're walking, if you want, if it helps, you can say like lifting, placing, moving my arm, because that's a better thought than proliferating. Or when we're with the breath, that's why sometimes a mantra helps, you know, in-breath going in, out-breath going out, or Buddha, because we're substituting, quite often the breath is too refined to stay with. So if we're with that, then our mind's going to go off and think. So we need a coarser meditation object or something to tie the mind to. And so every time the mind goes off, then we're aware that it's gone off. And once we can gently let go, then we just come back to the meditation again. It goes off, comes back. And so what if that happens? A whole meditation sometimes. But eventually, we get a meditation where peace arises. And once we get the taste of peace, then we start to see the benefit of meditation. And then once we find a meditation object that suits us, we should hold on to that and develop it as much as possible. But we just grow slowly. And so like maybe starting with a 15-minute meditation is a good goal. And then so you don't grow beyond that until your mindfulness is sharp. And then, you know, it's probably impractical to meditate as a layperson too much. But over time, that power will develop. So even 3 hours a day, most people, if they looked at their lives, they have 3 hours a day spare that they could actually use for meditation. But as you meditate more, most people, because the mind is clear, actually needs less sleep as well. Because the mind and the body become stronger from the strength of the mind. And so to the point where in the Thai forest tradition, many of them just sleep 4 or 5 hours a night. That's like the standard that people train for. But of course, you just have to look at your own mind and see the result. There's no point forcing these things. You know, that's for people who are already practicing a lot and they have a strong mind. So that's all the supporting factors for meditation. And for people who are Buddhists, it's like you have a Dharma follower, so that's somebody who's interested in the teachings of the Buddha, and you have the faith follower. And so it's useful to find out what kind of person we are, because that will teach us how we get our inspiration. Without inspiration, it's very hard to practice. And then find a teacher's teaching that's suitable to one and try and stick to that and follow that advice. And then it's just a matter of getting ourselves up to a point of steady practice. So once we know what the supporting factors are, we just move towards steady practice. And steady practice is where there's tireless persistence. At whatever level we're at, we're gathering towards the good, yoking ourselves to that. And a simple way of doing that is when we go to bed at night, or before we go to bed at night, is just reflect on the good that we've done that day. And then go, okay, well, you know, these things were good, so I'll move towards that. These other things weren't so good, so try and give them up. And that simple process of looking at our actions is a way for us to actually move in that direction. And it is actually based on two verses in the Dhammapada, the short verses of the Buddha. So, was there any question about anything?
Any question about anything?
Or anything to do with Dhamma practice, meditation? Welcome to the new people. Any question?
A very topical question.
Yes.
Can dead people have birthdays? Because next Monday is the Queen's birthday.
Well, I mean, it's...
Technically not the day of the day, anyway.
No.
Maybe they should change it into King.
Yeah, I mean, it's just more like once people have died, that's an opportunity for the family and other people to just have respect on special days. That's mainly the thing. It's like the teaching of the Buddha says, you know, like for parents, for example, we owe our parents a great debt of gratitude. Even if we carried our parents around on our shoulders the rest of our life, we wouldn't repay the debt to them. That's a pretty big debt. But he said, actually, if we teach them the Dhamma, if we teach them how to live morally and spiritually, then we will repay our debt to them. But as in lay people, meaning that we should always learn to give up our own pride and conceit and have respect for the elders and try and look out for the wise in the elders and then have kind of faith and respect in that. Something that's has to be cultivated. It doesn't arise on its own, but it's a very important part of life to know, like, who is our seniors and who is our juniors, and so we have kindness to the people who are junior to us, and also see that even though they're our juniors, that we may be able to learn something from them. But the oldest in the community and the oldest in our families is somebody who we should really look out for. And then once people have died, we should still try and give tribute to elders in our family, just as a way of, as a social cohesion, and remembering, you know, all the good that those beings did. And so that's a very important thing. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
When we have to let go of things, mm-hmm. what are the strategies we can use to, when we grieve?
Mm-hmm.
What are the things we can do to let go of things in grief?
In what way? Mental things or?
Yeah, in physical world we have attachments and we have sufferings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we come to a point thinking that we have to let go of this,
mm-hmm.
how can we do that? What is the method we can use?
Okay, so what I usually find is most useful is choose what the thing is and then use the peace of our meditation. And if you can't develop any peace in your meditation, then you can even make a mantra like, so find something that is at the root of it, like what is the root of that problem? Is it worry? Is it worldliness? Is it desire? Is it concern for the other people's minds? Like, you have to first of all look at the problem that's arising and realize why you were responding like that. So for me, it's different things to depends on the cause. So first try and identify the cause, and then, so let's say it's worldliness. You know, sometimes we're just caught up in all the problems of the world, and it's got nothing to do with us. And then so, and then you could do a meditation for a while, like free from worldliness, perfectly at peace. Free from worldliness, perfectly at peace. So you develop your breath meditation for a while, focused on the thought of giving up worldliness and developing peace. And like do that for 5 or 10 minutes and keep doing that each day. I had a thing. It's funny, but even as a monk, every now and then one of the hindrances will arise out of nowhere. And then suddenly, you know, you've got, irritation or righteous indignation or worry or something. And it becomes so strong. It's like a train out of control. It comes out of nowhere. But the more you develop this ability to identify what it is and then see clearly, just get it down to one word, like, you know, where is this coming from? And then develop a wisdom approach and sustain a meditation with that. And the other way is to develop your peace meditation and then focus on that. And just say, okay, well, how can I let go of this? And ask yourself, you know, what do I need to develop in my mind to develop strength so this won't come up? So either way, either you develop the peace with the wisdom, or you use the peace and then develop the wisdom afterwards. Another simple one is just equanimity. Equanimity answers everything. And so you just see, sorry, it's not in brief anymore, but you just see equanimity is just like covering everything with white sheets. So there's equanimity in meditation, but there's equanimity through wisdom. So if I covered everybody in this room with a white sheet, and everything in this room with a white sheet, and myself with a white sheet, what would there be to worry about now? All that's left is whiteness. What is this like? So there's just evenness now. There's nothing to be worried about. And so you can use the wisdom approach to just focus on that. And everything that arises, you watch the mind door and just throw a white sheet on it. You say, what's the problem? It's covered with a white sheet. What's the problem? It's covered with a white sheet. Until your mind settles down. And once your mind settles down, then you can do the meditation. And so they're the three approaches. One, you develop wisdom and then peace. One, you develop them both together, or one, you develop peace and wisdom. And so, if we can't solve our problems when they arise, then what's the point of meditation? So we need to learn to be able to solve our problems in daily life, and then we use our meditation as a time to bolster our peace. And so then we can have less trouble in the future dealing with the same problems. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. And they record these online, so if you can ask Tola for the link. So you can listen to it later if you forget. Okay. Running a little bit over time. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss, and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of illusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Blessing. Sukhityo vivacantu saparoko vinasatu mate pavantvantarayo sukhidika yukopava apivadana silisanicha Uta pachayino chataro dhamma vatanti ayuvano sukham phalam. Okay, and a moment now.